He had taken a stab at sleeping, but it had been useless. Finally, at 6, Jack Braun kicked aside the entangling bedclothes, stripped off sweat-soaked pajamas, dressed, and went in search of food. 5 months of hunched shoulders and nervous backward glances, 5 months in which he had never spoken, refused to grant him even eye contact. Had the hope of rehabilitation really been worth this amount of hell? The swarm invasion was to blame. It had pulled him back out of the womb of real estate and California evenings and poolside sex. Here was a real crisis. No ace, no matter how tainted, would be unwelcome. And he'd done good, stomping all over monsters in Kentucky and Texas. And he discovered something interesting. Most of the new young aces didn't know who the hell he was. A few, Hiram Worcester, the turtle, had known, and it had mattered, but it was bearable. So maybe there was a way to come back, to be a hero again. Hartman had announced the world tour. Jack had always admired Hartman, admired the way he'd led the fight to repeal certain parts of the Exotic Powers Control Act. He called the senator and offered to foot part of the bill. Money was always welcome to a politician, even if it wasn't being used to finance a campaign. Jack found himself on the plane. And most of it hadn't been bad. There'd been plenty of action with women, most notably with Fantasy. They had lain in bed one night in Italy, and she'd told him with vicious wit about Tachyon's impotency. And he'd laughed too loud and too long, trying to diminish Tachyon, trying to make him less of a threat. Over the years, he'd absorbed a bit about Takesian culture from the interviews he'd read. Vengeance was definitely part of the code. So he'd watched his back and waited for Tachyon to act. And nothing had happened. The strain was killing him. And then had come last night. He smeared butter on the last roll on the bread basket, washed down the hard, crusted bite with a sip of the unbelievably strong French coffee. He sure wished these Frenchies had a concept of a real breakfast. He could order an American breakfast, of course, but the cost was as unbelievable as the coffee. This basket of dry bread and coffee was costing him $10. Add in some eggs and bacon, and the cost soared to nearly $30 for breakfast. Suddenly, the absurdity of the thought struck him. He was a rich man, not a depression farm boy from North Dakota. His contribution to this tour had been big enough to buy him a piece of the big 747, or at least the jet fuel to fly it. Tachyon was entering the hotel, and the hair on the nape of Jack's neck prickled. The door of the small restaurant gave him only a limited view, and soon the alien was out of sight. Jack felt the muscles in his neck and shoulders relax, and with a sigh, he lifted a finger and ordered a full American breakfast. Tachyon had looked funny. Fork moved mechanically from plate to mouth, holding himself real stiff. Folded newspaper along his thigh, like a soldier on dress parade. None of his business what the bastard was getting up to. But last night was his business. Anger ate through his belly like a physical pain. Sure, the bomb couldn't have hurt him, but he took my mind. Casually, like a man tasting a mint, reducing him in an instant from man to object. Jack mopped up the last of the yolk while anger and outrage grew. God damn it! It was stupid to be scared of a pint-sized fairy in fancy dress. Not scared, Jack's mind quickly amended. He'd stayed away from the alien out of politeness, an acknowledgement of how much Tachyon hated him. But now, Tachyon had changed the rules. He'd taken his mind. That he wasn't going to allow to pass. They looked like two little red mouths, bullet in, bullet out. Tack seated in his undershorts, jabbed in a hypodermic, depressed the plunger, waited for the painkiller to take effect. Just for good measure, he'd given himself a tetanus shot and an injection of penicillin. Spent hypos littered the table. A gauze pad lay ready, a roll of cotton. But for the moment, he would let it seep and do some hard thinking. So Donnell had not lied. She had just not told all. Giselle was dead. The question was how, or did that matter? Probably not. What mattered was that she had married and born a son, my grandson, and he had to be found. And the father. Well, what of him? Assuming he was still alive, he was no fit guardian for the boy. The father, or unknown others, were manipulating this Takesian gift to spread terror. So where to start? Undoubtedly at Donnell's apartment, then to the Hall of Records to search for the marriage license and birth certificate. But that attack on Donnell and himself had been no accident. They, whoever they were watching. So, however distasteful, he was going to have to make an effort to blend in. Braun spent a few moments dithering in the hall, but outrage won over prudence. He tested the door, found it locked, gave a hard twist, and broke the knob. Stepped over the threshold and froze in astonishment at the sight of Takian, scissors at the ready, seated in the midst of a circle of snipped red locks. The Takesian gaped back, a final hank of that improbable hair clutched in a hand. How dare you? What in the hell are you doing? As their first exchange in almost 40 years, it seemed to lack something. In quick flicks like the shuddering of a camera, the rest of the scene came into focus. Jack's forefinger shot out. That's a bullet wound. Nonsense. The gauze was laid quickly over the white thigh with its peppering of red-gold hairs. Now get out of my room. Not until I have some answers out of you. Who the hell has been shooting at you? He snapped his fingers. The bomb at Versailles. You got a line into the people. No! Far too quick and far too strong. Have you told the authorities? There is no need. This is not a bullet wound. I know nothing of the terrorists. The scissors sawed viciously through the last piece of hair. It fluttered to the floor, ironically forming a shape very reminiscent of a question mark. Why are you cutting your hair? Because I feel like it. Now get out before I take your mind and make you go. You do, and I'll come back and break your damn neck. You've never forgiven me. You have that right. You threw a goddamn bomb at me. Unfortunately, I knew it wouldn't hurt you. The long, slender fingers played about his cropped head, fluttering among the curls until they clustered about his face. It had the effect of making him appear suddenly very young. Braun stepped in on him, rested his hands on either arm of the chair, effectively trapping Takian. This tour is important. If you get up to some crazy stunt, it could damage everybody's reputation. You, I don't give a damn about, but Greg Hartman is important. The alien looked away and gazed woodenly out the window. Despite being clad only in shirt and shorts, he managed to make it seem regal. I'll go to Hartman. There was a flicker of alarm deep in the lilac eyes, quickly suppressed. Fine, go. Anything to be rid of you. Silence stretched between them. Suddenly, Braun asked, Are you in trouble? No reply. If you are, tell me. Maybe I can help. The long lashes lifted and Takian looked him fully in the eyes. There was nothing young about the narrow face now. It looked as cold and old and as implacable as death. I've had enough of your help for one lifetime. Thank you. Jack almost ran from the room. Tachyon pulled off the soft brown fedora and crumpled it agitatedly in his hands. The tiny two-room flat looked as if it had been struck by a cyclone. Drawers stood open. A cheap picture frame stood forlornly empty on a scarred table. What had it held that was so significant? It had to be removed. The police? He wondered. No. They would have been more careful. So Danny's killers had been here, and the police were yet to come, which meant Tack had to hurry. The newly purchased jeans felt stiff against his skin, and he tugged fretfully at the crotch while he riffled through the paperbacks that littered the front room. A faint rasp sounded from the bedroom. Tachyon froze, crept cat-footed to the hot plate, and lifted the knife lying next to it. In a quick rush, he crossed the room and pressed himself against the wall, ready to stab whatever came through the connecting door. Careful, quiet footsteps, but enough vibration for Tack to tell that his opponent was big. Two sets of soft breaths from either side of the wall, Tack held his, waited. The man came through the door in a rush. Tachyon lunged in low, ready to drive the blade up beneath the ribs. The blade snapped, and gold light flashed across the dingy apartment walls. Jack Braun, forming his hand into a gun, placed his forefinger firmly between Tachyon's eyes. Bang, bang, you're dead. God damn you! In a blaze of temper, he flung the broken knife against the wall. What are you doing here? I followed you. I never saw you. I know, I'm pretty good at this. The implication was clear. Why can't you just leave me alone? Because you're getting in way over your head. I can take care of myself. A derisive snort. If it hadn't been you, I'd have taken you out. Tack cried. Yeah? And what if there'd been more than one? Or if they'd had guns? I don't have time to discuss this with you. The police may be here any minute, the alien threw over his shoulder as he stormed into the bedroom and continued his search. Police! Hold it! What is going on? Why the police? Because the woman who lived in this flat was murdered this morning. Oh, great! And why does this involve you? Tachyon's mouth tightened mulishly. Braun gathered up the front of the alien's shirt, hefted him off the ground, and held him at eye level, noses almost touching. Tachyon. It was a warning rumble. It's a private matter. Not if the police are involved, it isn't. I can handle it myself. I don't think so. You couldn't even spot me. Tachyon sulked. Tell me what's going on. I just might help you. Ah, very well, he snapped pettishly. I'm searching for any clue as to the whereabouts of my grandson. That took some explaining. Tachyon fired out the tale in quick staccato sentences while they finished pawing through the jumble, turning up absolutely nothing. So you see, I have to find him first and get him out of the country before the French authorities realize what they possess, he concluded, laying his hand on the doorknob, and heard a key rasp in the lock. Oh, shit, whispered Tack. Police, mouthed Jack. Undoubtedly, the Tachyon mouthed back. Fire escape, Jack pointed back over his shoulder. They fled. Let's see what we've got. Braun paused to light a cigarette. Tachyon stopped wolfing down his enormous and very belated lunch and fished the paper from his jeans, tossed it, only to have it land fluttering in the mustard jar. God damn it, be careful, said Jack, aggrieved, and mopped at the paper with his napkin. Tachyon continued to shovel it in. With an annoyed grunt, the ace pulled out a pair of reading glasses and peered at the Tachyon's florid hand. Giselle Bacor, wed François Andréot, in a civil ceremony on December 5, 1971. One child, Blaise Jeannot Andréot, born May 7, 1975. Giselle Andréot, killed in a shootout with industrialist Simon de Montfort's personal bodyguard, November 28, 1984. Both husband and wife were members of the French Communist Party. François Andréot had been pulled in for questioning, but was released when nothing conclusive could be found. They had tried the simple expedient of checking the phone book, and, not surprisingly, Andréot had not been listed. Jack sighed, rocked back in his chair, and returned his glasses to his shirt pocket. The Eiffel Tower cast an elongated shadow across the outdoor café. "It's getting late, and we've got that dinner at the Tour Eiffel." "I'm not going." "Oh? No, I'm going to talk to Claude Bonnel."
"Who?"
Bonnel, Le Miroir, you know?"
"Why?"
"Because he's a major figure in the Communist Party. He may be able to obtain Andrieux's address for me."
"And if that fails?"
The smoke from the cigarette formed a loop in the air between them. "I don't want to think about that."
"Well, you better, if you really want to find this guy."
"So what's your suggestion?"
"Try tracing the materials used in the bomb. They had to buy the stuff somewhere."
Tack made a face. "Sounds slow and tedious."
"It is."
"Then I'll pin my hope on Bonnel."
"Fine, you hope, and I'll pursue my bomb idea. Of course, how am I going to get that information? I'm not certain. I suppose you could always go to see Rochambeau and pick his brains."
Tachyon steepled his fingers before his face and peered speculatively over the top at Jack. "I have a better idea."
"What?"
"Don't sound so suspicious. You and Billy Ray could talk to Rochambeau about the bomb. Say that you think it was meant for the senator. It might have been, for all we know. Suggest that you pool information."
"Might work." Jack ground out the cigarette. "Billy Ray is a Justice Department ace and Hartman's bodyguard. Of course, he's bound to ask why I'm involved."
"Just tell him it's because you're Golden Boy."
And the tone was undiluted acid. Bonnel's dressing room backstage at the Lido was typical. The strong odor of cold cream, grease paint, and hairspray overlaying the fainter sense of old sweat and stale perfume. Tachyon straddled a chair, arms resting along the back, and watched the Joker put the final touches on his makeup.
"Could you hand me my ruff?"
Bonnel clasped it about his neck, rose, took one final critical look at the black and white Harlequin costume, and settled back into the battered wooden chair.
"All right, Docteur, I'm ready. Now tell me what I can do for you."
"I need a favor." They spoke in French.
"Which is?"
"Do you have membership lists, addresses for your members? I assume we're speaking of the party?" "Oh, forgive me. Yes."
"And to answer you, yes, we do."
Bonnel was not helping him any. Tack plowed awkwardly on.
"Could you obtain an address for me?"
"That would depend on what you want it for."
"Nothing nefarious, I assure you. A personal matter."
Bonnel straightened the already meticulously arranged pots and tubes on his dressing table.
"Doctor, you presume a great deal. We have met only once, yet you come to me asking for private information. And if I were to ask you, why?"
"I'd rather not say."
"I rather thought that would be your answer, so I'm afraid I really must refuse."
Exhaustion, tension, and the throbbing ache from his leg slammed down like a curling storm wave. Tack laid his head on his arms, fought tears, considered just giving up. A gentle but firm hand caught his chin
and forced his head up. This really means a great deal to you, doesn't it?
More than you can know.
So tell me, so I will know. Can't you trust me? Just a little?
I lived in Paris long ago. Have you been a communist for long? He asked abruptly. Ever since I was able to comprehend politics. Then I'm surprised I didn't meet you all those long years ago. I knew them all. Torrance, Lena Goldoni, Danel.
I wasn't in Paris then. I was still in Marseille, getting the crap beat out of me by my supposedly normal neighbors. His smile was bitter. France has not always been so kind to her wild cards.
I'm sorry.
Why should you be?
Because it's my fault.
That's an exceedingly silly and self-indulgent attitude.
Thank you so very much.
The past is dead, buried, and gone forever, past recall. Only the present and the future matter, Doctor.
And I think that's a silly and simplistic attitude. The actions of the past have consequences for the present and the future. 36 years ago, I came to this country broken and bitter. I slept with a young girl. Now I return to find that I'd left a more permanent mark on this place than I had thought. I sired a child who was born, lived, and died without my ever knowing of her existence. I could curse her mother for that, and yet perhaps she was wise. For the first 13 years of Giselle's life, her father was a drunken derelict. What could I have given her? He paced away and stood rigidly regarding a wall, then whirled and rested his shoulders against the cool plaster. I lost my chance with her, but the ideal has granted me another. She had a son, my grandchild, and I want him.
And the father?
Is a member of your party.
You say you want him. What, you would steal him from his father? Tact rubbed wearily at his eyes. 48 hours without sleep was taking its toll.
I don't know. I haven't thought that far ahead. All I want is to see him, to hold him, to look into the face of my future. Bonnell slapped his hands onto his thighs and pushed up from the chair.
C'est bien, docteur. A man deserves a chance to look upon the intersection of his past, present, and future. I will find you this man.
Just give his address. There is no reason for you to be involved.
He might take fright. I can reassure him, set up a meeting. His name?
François Andreu.
Bonnell noted it. Very good. So I will speak to this man, and then I will ring you at the Ritz.
I'm no longer staying there. You can reach me at the Lys, on the left bank.
I see. Any particular reason?
No.
I must work on that innocent expression. It is very charming, if not terribly convincing.
Tachyon flushed, and Bonnell laughed.
There, there, don't take offense. You've told me enough of your secrets tonight. I won't press you for any more.
The junket was dining at the expensive Tour Eiffel. Tachyon, leaning on the rail of the observation deck, fidgeted and waited for Braun to emerge. Through the windows of the restaurant, he could see that the party had reached the brandy, coffee, cigars, speeches stage. The door opened, and Mistral, giggling, darted out. She was followed by Captain Donatien Racine, one of France's more prominent aces. His sole power was flight, but that coupled with the fact he was career military had ensured that the press dubbed him Tricolor. It was a name he hated. Gripping the American about her slender waist, Racine carried them over the protective railing. Mistral gave him a quick kiss, pushed free of his encircling arm,
and floated away on the gentle breezes that sighed about the tower. Her great blue and silver cape spread around her until she resembled an exotic moth drawn by the glittering lights webbing the tower. Watching the couple darting and swooping in an intricate game of tag, Tachyon suddenly felt very weary and very old and very earthbound. The restaurant doors flew open, and the delegation flowed out like water through a broken dam. After 5 months of formal dinners and endless speeches, it was no wonder they fled. Braun, elegant in his white tie and tails, paused to light a cigarette. Tachyon touched him with a thread of telepathy. Jack. He stiffened, but gave no other outward sign. Greg Hartman glanced back. Jack, are you coming? I'll catch up with you. Think I'll enjoy the air and the view and watch those crazy kids skydive. He pointed to Mistral and Racine. A few moments later, he joined Tachyon at the rail. Bonnell's going to set up a meeting. Braun grunted, flicked ash. The Sûreté were at the hotel when I got back. They try to be subtle about questioning the delegation as to your whereabouts, but the news hounds are snuffling. They sense a story. The Dakesian shrugged it aside with a hunch of the shoulder. Will you come with me to the meeting? Ancestors, how it stuck in the throat to ask him for help.
Sure.
I may need help with the father. So you're going to do whatever it takes. I want him.
Montmartre. Where artists, legitimate and otherwise, swarmed like locusts, ready to fall upon the unwary tourist. A portrait of your beautiful wife, monsieur! The cost, politely never mentioned, then when it was completed, a charge sufficient to purchase an old master. Tour buses groaned up the hill and disgorged their eager passengers. The gypsy children, circling like vultures, moved in. The European travelers, wise to the ways of these innocent-faced thieves, drove them away with loud threats. The Japanese and the Americans, lulled by sparkling black eyes and dark faces, allowed them to approach. Later they would rue it when they discovered the loss of wallets, watches, jewelry. So many people, and one small boy. Braun, hands on hips, gazed out across the plaza before Sacré-Cœur. It was awash with people, easels thrust up like masts from a colorful surging sea. He sighed, checked his watch. They're late. Patience. Braun stared pointedly at his watch again. The gypsy children, attracted by the slim gold band of the Longines, crept forward.
Beat it! Jack roared. Jesus, where do they all come from? Is there a gypsy factory the same way there's a hooker factory?
They're usually sold by their mothers to talent scouts from France and Italy. They're then trained to steal and work like slaves for their owners.
Jesus, sounds like something out of Dickens.
Tachyon shaded his eyes with one slim hand and searched for Bonnell.
You know you were supposed to address a conference of researchers today.
Yes.
Well, did you call to cancel?
No, I forgot. I have more important things on my mind right now than genetic research.
I'd say that's exactly what you have on your mind, came Braun's dry reply. A taxi pulled up, and Bonnell struggled painfully out. He was followed by a man and a small boy. Tachyon's fingers dug deep into Jack's bicep.
Look, dear God.
What?
That man, he's the clerk from the hotel.
Huh?
He was at the Intercontinental.
The trio were walking toward them. Suddenly the father froze, pointed at Jack, gestured emphatically, grabbed the child by the wrist, and hustled for the taxi.
No, dear God, no!
Tachyon ran forward a few steps, reached out, his power closing about their minds like a vice. They froze. He walked slowly toward them, felt his breath go short as he devoured the small, stubborn face beneath its cap of red hair. The boy was fighting with not insignificant power, and only a quarter Takesian. Pride surged through Tak. Suddenly, he was flung to the ground, fists and rocks raining down upon him. He clung desperately to the control, while the gypsy children plucked at him, removing wallet, watch, and all the time continuing the hysterical beating. Jack waded in and began plucking urchins off him.
"No, no, catch them! Don't worry about me!" screamed Tak.
With a leg sweep, he brought two to the ground, lurched to one knee, stiffened his fingers, and jabbed them hard into one gangling teenager's throat. The boy fell back, choking.
Jack hesitated, turned toward Andrea and the boy, broke into a run. Takian, distracted, watched his progress. Never even saw the boot come swinging in. Pain exploded in his temple. Distantly, he heard someone shouting. Then bitter darkness.
Bunnell was wiping his face with a damp handkerchief when he finally came round. Desperately, Takian levered up onto his elbows, then fell back as the motion sent waves of pain through his head and filled the back of his throat with nausea.
"Did you get them?"
"No." Jack was holding a bumper like a man displaying a prize catch. "When you went under, they ran for it and made it into the cab. I tried to grab the car, but could only get the bumper. It came off," he added unnecessarily. Jack eyed the interested crowd that had surrounded them and shooed them away.
"Then we've lost them."
"What did you expect? You turn up with the Judas Ace," said Bunnell angrily.
Jack flinched, murmured through stiff lips. "That was a long time ago."
"Some of us don't forget, and others of us shouldn't," he glared at Takian. "I thought I could trust you."
"Jack, go away."
"Well, fuck you too."
Long, jerky strides carried him into the crowd and out of sight.
"It's funny, but I feel very badly about that."
He gave himself a shake.
"So what do we do now?"
"First, I extract a promise from you that there will be no more stunts like today."
"All right.
I'll reset the meeting for tonight. And this time, come alone."
Jack wasn't sure why he did it. After the insult Takian had given him, he should have just washed his hands of the whole thing, or told the Sûreté everything he knew. Instead, he turned up at the lease with an ice pack and aspirin.
"Thank you, but I do have a medical kit."
Jack tossed the bottle several times. "Oh yeah, well then I'll take them. This whole thing has given me a headache." Tak lifted the pack from his eye.
"Why you?"
"Lie down and leave that thing on your eye." He scratched at his chin.
"Look, let me just throw something out to you. Doesn't this whole thing strike you as just a little too convenient?"
"In what way?"
But Jack could tell from the little alien's cautious tone that he'd struck a nerve.
"Instead of just giving you Andrio's address, Bunnell insists on setting up a meeting. They tried to split."
"Because you were there."
"Yeah, right. You mind control them, then you just happen to get attacked by a gang of gypsy children. I've done a little checking around. They never do that kind of thing. I think somebody had this arranged ahead of time to make certain you couldn't use your mind control." "And what about Andrew? You said he was a clerk at the hotel? Then why did he deny any knowledge of Danell? She was his mother-in-law, for Christ's sake. This thing stinks to high heaven."
Takian flung the ice pack against the wall.
"So what do you suggest I do?" "Don't work with Bunnell anymore. Don't go to any more meetings. Let me see what I can do with the bomb fragments. Rochambeau has agreed to work with Ray. That could take weeks. We leave in a few days." "You are fucking obsessed with this." "Yes." "Why? Is it because you're impotent? Is that the big deal here?"
"I don't wish to discuss this."
"I know you don't. But you've got to. You're not thinking this through, Takian. What it could do to the tour, to your reputation, to mine for that matter. We're withholding vital evidence pertaining to a murder."
"You didn't have to become involved."
I know that, and sometimes I wish to Christ I hadn't, but I'm into it now, so I'll see it through to the end. So are you going to sit tight and see what I can find?
Yes, I'll wait to see what you find out.
Jack shot him a suspicious glance.
Well, guess that'll have to do.
Oh, Jack, the big ace paused, hand on the doorknob, and looked back. I apologize for this afternoon. It was wrong of me to send you away. It was obvious from the Takesian's expression what this was costing him.
Okay, Jack replied gruffly.
It was an old house, a very old house in the university district. Cracks cut the dingy plaster walls, and the musty odor of mold hung in the air. Bunnell gave Takian's arm a hard squeeze.
Remember not to expect too much. This child doesn't know you.
Takian barely heard him, certainly paid no attention. He was already heading up the stairs. There were five people in the room, but Takian saw only the boy. Perched on a stool, he was swinging one foot, slamming his heel rhythmically into a battered wooden leg. His fine straight hair lacked the metallic copper fire of his grandsire's, but it was nonetheless a deep rich red. Tak felt a surge of pride at this evidence of his prepotence. Straight red brows gave Blaze an overly serious expression that set oddly on the narrow child's face. His eyes were a brilliant purple-black. Standing behind, a hand possessively on his son's shoulder, was Andreu. Takian studied him with the critical eye of a Takesian Psi Lord evaluating breeding stock. Not bad. Human, of course, but not bad. Definitely handsome, and he appeared intelligent. Still, it was hard to tell. If only he could run tests. He tried to close his mind to the unwelcome suspicion that this man had been instrumental in Danny's death. He looked back to Blaze and found the boy studying him with equal interest. There was nothing shy about the gaze. Suddenly, Tak's shields repelled a powerful mind assault.
Trying to pay me back for yesterday? Mais oui, you took my mind.
You take people's minds?
Of course. No one can stop me.
I can. The brows snapped together in a thunderous frown. I'm Takian. I'm your grandfather.
You don't look like a grandfather.
My kind live a very long time.
Will I?
Longer than a human. The boy seemed pleased with this oblique reference to his alienness. As they talked, Tak made a preliminary probe of his abilities. An unbelievable mind-control aptitude for one so young, and all self-taught. That was the truly amazing thing. With proper instruction, he would be a force to be reckoned with. No teke, no precog, and worst of all, almost no telepathy. He was virtually mind-blind. That's what comes of unrestricted and unplanned breeding.
Doctor, said Claude, won't you sit down?
First, I would like to give Blaze a hug. He looked inquiringly at the boy, who made a face.
I don't like hugs and kisses.
Why not?
It makes me feel like ants are on me.
A common mentat reaction. You will not feel that way with me.
Why not?
Because I am your kin and kind. I understand you better than anyone else in the world can ever understand you. François Andrieux shifted angrily.
Well, I'll try it, said Blaze decisively, and slid off his stool.
Again, Takian was pleased with his assurance. As his arms closed about his grandson's small form, tears rushed into his eyes.
You're crying, Blaze accused.
Yes.
Why?
Because I am so very happy to have found you, to know that you exist in the world.
Bunnell cleared his throat, a discreet little sound. As loath as I am to interrupt this, I'm really afraid I must, Doctor.
Takian stiffened wearily.
We have to talk a little business. Business? The word was dangerously low.
Yes, I've given you what you want, he indicated Blaze with a flip of a tiny hand. Now you have to give me what I want. Francois, take him.
Father and son left. Tachyon speculatively studied the remaining men.
Please don't consider a mine-assisted escape. There are more of us waiting outside this room, and my companions are armed.
I somehow assumed they would be.
Tack settled into a sagging sofa. It sent up a puff of dust under his weight.
So you are a member of this little gang of galloping terrorists?
No, sir. I lead it.
And you had Danny killed?
No. That was an act of blatant stupidity for which Francois has been chastised. I disapprove of subordinates acting on their own initiative. They so often screw up. Don't you agree?
Tachyon's late cousin, Rabdan, came instantly to mind, and he found himself nodding, pulled himself up short. There was something very outré about this chatty little conversation, faced as he was with the man who had attempted to kill hundreds at Versailles.
Oh dear, and I had so hoped that Andrieux was bright, mused Tachyon. Then he asked, Is this a kidnapping for ransom?
Oh no, Doctor, you're quite beyond price.
So I've always thought.
No. I need your help. In 2 days, there will be a great debate between all the presidential candidates. We intend to kill as many of them as we can.
Even your own candidate?
In a revolution, sometimes sacrifice is necessary. But for your information, I have little loyalty to the Communist Party. They have betrayed the people, lost the will and the strength to make the difficult decisions. The mandate has passed to us.
Tack rested his forehead on a hand.
Oh, please, don't blurt slogans at me. It's one of the most tiresome things about you people.
May I outline my plan?
I don't see any way I can prevent you.
The security will undoubtedly be very tight.
Undoubtedly.
Benoit shot him a sharp glance at the irony. Tachyon gazed innocently back.
Rather than attempt to run this gauntlet with weapons of our own, we will use those already provided. You and Blaze will mind control as many guards as possible and have them wreck the platform with automatic weapons fire. It should have the desired result.
Interesting. But what can you possibly gain by this?
The destruction of France's ruling elite will throw the country into chaos. When that occurs, I won't need your esoteric powers. Guns and bombs will suffice. Sometimes the simplest things are often the best.
What a philosopher you are. Perhaps you should set yourself up as a guide to the young.
I already have. I'm Blaise's beloved Uncle Claude.
Well, this has, of course, been instructional, but I very much regret that I must refuse.
Not surprising. I had anticipated this, but consider, Doctor, I hold your grandson.
You won't harm him. He's too precious to you.
True, but my threat is not of death. If you refuse to accommodate me in this, I will be forced to have certain very unpleasant things done to you, being careful to ensure that you live. I will then disappear with Blaze. You might find it somewhat difficult to trace us when you are a bedridden cripple.
He smiled in satisfaction at the look of horror on Tachyon's face.
Jean will escort you to your room now. There you can reflect upon my offer, and I'm certain it's your way clear to help me.
I doubt it, gritted Tachyon,
regaining command of his voice, but it was hollow bravado, and Benel undoubtedly knew it. The room turned out to be the very cold and dank basement of the house,
Hours later, Blaise arrived with his dinner.
"I have come to visit with you," he announced, and Tak sighed, again admiring and regretting Vanel's cunning.
The Joker had obviously made a careful study of Takyan, his attitudes, and culture. He ate while Blaise, chin resting in his cupped hands, gazed thoughtfully at him. Tak set aside his fork.
"You are very silent. I thought we were going to visit."
"I don't know what to say to you. It's very strange."
"What is?"
"Finding out about you. Now I'm not so special anymore, which bothers me. But it's also good to know,"
he considered. "That you are not alone," suggested Tak gently.
"Yes, that's it."
"Why do you help them?"
"Because they are right. The old institutions must fall."
"But people have died."
"Yes,"
he agreed, sunnily.
"Doesn't that bother you?"
"Oh no, they were bourgeois capitalist pigs and deserve to die. Sometimes killing is the only way."
"A very Takisian attitude."
"You will help us, won't you? It will be fun."
"Fun. It's his upbringing," Tak consoled himself.
"Endow any child with this kind of unsupervised power, and they would react the same." They talked. Takyan pieced together a picture of unfettered freedom, virtually no formal schooling, the excitement of playing hide-and-seek with the authorities. More chilling was the realization that Blaise did not withdraw from his victims when they died. Rather, he rode through the terror and pain of their final moment.
"There will be time to correct this," he promised himself.
"So, will you help?"
Blaise asked, hopping down from the chair.
"Uncle Claude says to be sure to ask you."
Seconds stretched into minutes as he considered. The noble course would be to tell Bunnell to go to hell. He considered Bunnell's gently worded threats and shuddered.
He had been bred and trained to seize the opportunity to turn defeat into victory. He would trust to that. Surely they could not guard him as closely at the rally.
"Tell Claude that I will help."
An exuberant hug. Alone, Takyan continued to reflect. He did have one other advantage, Jack, who would surely realize something had gone terribly wrong and alert the Sûreté. But his hope was founded on a man whose weakness was well known to him, and his fears on a man who, despite his civilized exterior, possessed no humanity.
Coming up on 24 hours since the little bastard had disappeared, Jack swung at the wall, pulled the punch just in time. Knocking out a wall at the Ritz wasn't going to help. Was Takyan in trouble? Despite his promise, had he gone off with Bunnell? And did that necessarily mean trouble? Was it possible he was merely playing hooky with his grandkid? If he was out visiting the zoo or whatever and Jack alerted the Sûreté and they found out about Blaise, Takyan would never forgive him. It would be another betrayal. Maybe his last one. The Takisian would find a way to get even this time. But if he's really in trouble? A knock pulled him from his distracted thoughts. One of Hartman's interchangeable aides stood in the hall.
"Mr. Braun, the senator would like to invite you to join him at the debate tomorrow."
"Debate? What debate?"
"All 1,011,
a condescending little laugh, "or however many candidates there are in this crazy race, will be taking part in a round-robin debate in the Luxembourg Gardens. The senator would like as many of the tour as possible to be there, to show support for this great European democracy, such as it is. Mr. Braun, are you all right?"
"Fine, yeah, I'm fine. You tell the senator I'll be there."
"And Dr. Takyan? The senator's very concerned by his continued absence."
"I think I can safely promise the senator that the doctor will be there too."
Closing the door, Jack quickly crossed to the phone and put in a call for Rochambeau.
a probable terrorist attack on the candidates. No need to mention the child, just an urgent need to call out the troops. And a long night of praying. He had guessed correctly that he had made the right choice. He should be sleeping, preparing mind and body for the morrow. His life and the future of his line depended upon his skill and speed and cunning. And on Jack Braun. Ironic that. If Jack had drawn the correct conclusion, if he had alerted the Sûreté, if there were sufficient officers, if Tachyon could stretch his talent beyond all limits and hold an unheard-of number of minds. He sat up on the rickety cot and hugged his stomach, sank back, and tried to relax. But it was a night for memories. Faces out of the past. Blythe. David. Earl. Danny. I'm gambling my life and the life of my grandchild on the man who destroyed Blythe. Lovely. But the possibility of dying can act as a spur for self-examination. Force a person to strip away the comforting, insulating little lies that buffer one from their most private guilts and regrets. Then give me those names! All right. All right. The power, lancing out, fragmenting her mind. Her mind. Her mind. But they wouldn't have known. But for Jack, and she wouldn't have absorbed their minds, but for Holmes, and she wouldn't have been there but for the paranoia of a nation, and no one would suffer had they not been born, thought Dak, quoting a favorite adage of his father's. Sometime one must stop excusing, accept responsibility for actions taken. Tisian Brandt to Sara. Jack Braun didn't destroy Blythe. You did. He flinched, prepared for it to hurt. Instead, he felt better, lighter, freer, at peace for the first time in so many, many years. He began to laugh, was not surprised when it turned to quiet tears. They lasted for some time. When the storm ended, he lay back, exhausted but calm, ready for tomorrow. After which he would return home and make a home and raise his child calmly and a little regretfully. He turned his back on the past. He was Tisian Brandt to Sara. Sek Halima, Sek Ragnar, Sek Omian, a prince of the House Ilkazam. And tomorrow, his enemies would learn to their pain and regret what it meant to stand against him. Claude, Blaise, and a driver remained in a car almost a block from the gardens. Tachyon, linked through the barrel of a Beretta with a stone-faced Andrieu, hovered at the outskirts of an enormous crowd. Parisians were nothing if not enthusiastic about their politics, but spotted throughout this sea of humanity, like an insidious infection, were the other 15 members of Bonnell's cell, waiting for blood to flow and nurture their violent dreams. On the stand, the candidates, all 7 of them, about half the delegation seated in chairs directly in front of the bunting-hung platform. There was no way they could escape without injury if Tack should fail and the shooting begin. Jack came into view, hands thrust deep into pants pockets. He paced and frowned out over the throng. Blaze was a rider in Tachyon's mind, ready to sense the tiniest use of telepathy.
His power might be slight, but he was sensitive enough to detect the shift in focus such mind communication required. His presence suited his grandsire just fine. It would make what was to come all the easier. Carefully, Tachyon constructed a mind scrim of the scene. A false picture to lull his grandchild. He hedged it around with shields, presented it to Blaze. Then, from beneath its protective cover, he reached out, touched Jack's mind. "Don't jump. Keep frowning. Where are you?"
"Near gate. Edge of trees."
"Got it."
"Surite?"
"Everywhere. Terrorists?"
"Likewise. Everywhere."
"How?"
"They'll come to you."
"What?"
"Trust."
He withdrew and carefully constructed a trap. It was similar to the link he enjoyed with Baby when the ship boosted and amplified his own natural powers to allow for trans-space communication, but much, much stronger. Its teeth were very deep.
What might it do to Blaze?
No, there was no time for doubts. The mind snare snapped down. A mental scream of alarm from the boy. Desperate struggle, panting, resignation. The rider had become the ridden. Tachyon joined Blaze's power to his. It was like a bar of white, hot light. Carefully, he split it into strands. Each tendril snapped out like a burning whip. Settled on his captors, they became frozen statues. He was gasping with effort, sweat bursting from his forehead, running in rivulets into his eyes. He set them, marching, a regiment of zombies. As Andrieux stepped from his side, Tachyon forced his hand to move, to close about the Beretta, to pull it from his slave's limp grasp. Braun was leaping about, gesticulating, summoning help with great arm sweeps. "Hurry! Hurry!" He had to hold them, all of them. If he failed, Blaze was struggling again. It was like being kicked over and over again in the gut. One thread snapped to Claude Bonnel. With a cry, Tachyon dropped the control, ran for the gate. Behind him, there was the vicious snarl of an Uzi. Apparently, one of his captives had tried to run and been cut down by the French security forces. Perhaps it had been Andrieux. More gunfire, punctuating screams. A torrent of people swept past, almost knocking him from his feet. He tightened his grip on the Beretta, pumped harder, slid around the corner just as the dazed driver reached for the key. A blow from Tachyon's mind, and he collapsed under the steering wheel, and the blare of the horn was added to the pandemonium. Bonnel struggled from the car, gripping Blaze by the wrist. He went lurching and stumbling for a narrow, deserted side street. Tack flew after them, caught Blaze by his free hand, and wrenched him free. "Let me go! Let me go!" Sharp teeth bit deep into his wrist. Tachyon silenced the boy with a crushing imperative, supported the sleeping child with one arm. He and Bonnel regarded one another over the limp figure.
"Bravo, doctor, you outfoxed me, but what a media event my trial will be." "I'm afraid not." "Eh? I require a body, one infected with the wild card. Then the Surete will have their mysterious mentat ace and will look no further."
"You can't be serious. You can't mean to kill me in cold blood?"
He read the answer in Tachyon's implacable lilac gaze. Bonnel tottered back, came up short against the wall, moistened his lips.
"I treated you fairly, kindly. You took no hurt from me."
"But others have not fared so well. You shouldn't have sent Blaze to me. He was quick to tell me of your other triumphs. An innocent banker, controlled by Blaze, sent into his bank, carrying his own death. That bomb blast killed 17. Clearly a triumph."
Bonnel's face shifted, took on the aspect of Thomas Tudbury, the great and powerful turtle.
"Please, I beg you, at least grant me the opportunity for a trial." "No,
The features shifted again. Mark Meadows, Captain Trips, blinked confusedly at the gun.
I think the outcome is fairly predictable.
Danelle, but as she had been all those long years ago, I merely hasten your execution. A final transformation. Shoulder length, sable hair, cascading over the shoulders, long sooty lashes brushing at her cheeks, lifting to reveal eyes of a profound midnight blue. Blithe. Tacky. Please?
I'm sorry, but you're dead. And Tack shot him.
Ah, Dr. Tacquion, Franchot de Valmy rose from his desk, hand outstretched. France owes you a great debt of gratitude. How can we ever repay you?
By issuing me a passport and visa.
I'm afraid I don't understand. You, of course,
not for me. For Blaise Jeannot Andrieux.
De Valmy fiddled with a pen. Why not merely apply?
Because François Andrieux is currently in custody. Checks will be run, and I can't allow that.
Aren't you being a bit forthright with me?
Not at all. I know what an expert you are in falsified documents.
The Frenchman froze, and then shifted slowly to the back of his chair.
I know you are not an ace, Monsieur de Valmy. I wonder, how would the French public react to news of such a cheat? It would cost you the election.
De Valmy forced past stiff lips. I am a very capable public servant. I can make a difference for France.
Yes, but none of that is half so alluring as a wild card.
What you are asking is impossible. What if it's traced to me? What if...
Tacquion reached for the phone.
What are you doing?
Calling the press. I too can arrange press conferences at a moment's notice. One of the privileges of fame.
You'll get your documents.
Thank you.
I'll find out why you're doing this.
Tacquion paused at the door, glanced back. Then we'll each have a secret on the other, won't we?
The big plane was darkened for the late night hop to London. The first class section was deserted save for Tack, Jack, and Blaise, sleeping soundly in his grandfather's arms. There was something about the little tableau that warned everyone to stay well away.
How long are you going to keep him under?
The single reading light pulled fire from the twin redheads.
Until we reach London.
Will he ever forgive you?
He won't know.
About Bunnell, maybe, but the rest he'll remember.
You betrayed him.
Yes.
It was scarcely audible over the rumble of the engines.
Jack.
Yeah.
I forgive you.
Their eyes met. The human reached down, softly pushed back a lock of silky hair from the child's forehead.
Then I guess maybe there's hope for you too.
Legends by Michael Cusett. Read for you by Stefan Rudnitsky. 1. The month of April brought little in the way of relief to Muscovites staggered by an unusually cold winter. Following a brief flurry of southern breezes, which sent boys into the newly green football fields and encouraged pretty girls to discard their overcoats, the skies had darkened again, and a dreary, uninspired rain had begun to fall. To Polyakov, the scene was autumnal, and therefore entirely appropriate. His masters, bending in the new breeze from the Kremlin, had decreed that this would be Polyakov's last Moscow spring. The younger, less tainted Yurchenko would move up, and Polyakov would retire to a dacha far from Moscow. Just as well, Polyakov thought, since scientists were saying that weather patterns had changed because of the Siberian airbursts. There might never be a decent Moscow spring again. Nevertheless, even in its autumn clothes, Moscow had the ability to inspire him. From this window he could see the cluster of trees where the Moscow River skirted Gorky Park, and beyond that, looking appropriately medieval in the mist, were the domes of St. Basil's and the Kremlin. In Polyakov's mind, age equaled power, but then he was old. "You wanted to see me?" The voice interrupted his musings. A young major in the uniform of the Chief Intelligence Directorate of the General Staff, uncommonly known as the GRU, had entered. He was perhaps 35, a bit old to still hold the rank of major, Polyakov thought, especially with the Hero of the Soviet Union medal. With his classic White Russian features and sandy hair, the man looked like one of those unlikely officers whose pictures appeared on the cover of Red Star every day. "Molnia," Polyakov elected to use the young officer's code name rather than Christian name and patronymic. Initial formality was one of the interrogator's tricks. He held out his hand. The major hesitated, then shook it. Polyakov was pleased to note that Molnia wore black rubber gloves. So far, his information was correct. "Let's sit down." They faced each other across the polished wood of the conference table. Someone had thoughtfully provided water, which Polyakov indicated. "You have a very pleasant conference room here." "I'm sure it hardly compares with those at Dzerzhinsky Square," Molnia shot back with just the proper amount of insolence. Dzerzhinsky Square was the location of KGB headquarters. Polyakov laughed. "As a matter of fact, it's identical, thanks to central planning. Gorbachev is doing away with that, I understand. We've been known to read the Politburo's mail, too." "Good. Then you know exactly why I am here and who sent me." Molnia and the GRU had been ordered to cooperate with the KGB, and the orders came from the very highest places. That was the slim advantage Polyakov brought to this meeting, an advantage that, as the saying went, had all the weight of words written on water. Since he was an old man, and Molnia was the great Soviet ace. "Do you know the name Huntington Sheldon?" Molnia knew he was being tested and said tiredly, "He was CIA director from 1966 to 1972. "Yes, a thoroughly dangerous man. And last week's issue of Time magazine has a picture of him standing right in front of the Lubyanka, pointing up at the statue of Dzerzhinsky. Maybe there's a lesson in that, cousin." "Worry about your own security and leave our operations alone." "I wouldn't be here if you hadn't had such a spectacular failure. Unlike the KGB's perfect record." Molnia didn't try to hide his contempt. "Oh, we've had our failures, cousin. What's different about our operations is that they've been approved by the Intelligence Council. Now you're a party member. You couldn't have graduated from the Kharkov Higher Engineering School without being at least slightly familiar with the principles of collective thought. Successes are shared. So are failures. This operation you and Dolgov cooked up, what were you doing? Taking lessons from Oliver North?" Molnia flinched at the mention of Dolgov's name. A state secret, and more importantly, a GRU secret. Polyakov continued. "Are you worried about what we say, Major? Don't be. This is the cleanest room in the Soviet Union," he smiled. "My housekeepers swept it. What we say here is between us. So now, tell me," Polyakov said, "what the hell went wrong in Berlin?" The aftermath of the Hartmann kidnapping had been horrible. Though only a few right-wing German and American newspapers mentioned possible Soviet involvement, the CIA and other Western agencies made the connections. Finding the bodies, even mutilated as they were of those Red Army faction punks, had allowed the CIA to backtrack through their residences, cover names, bank accounts, and contacts, destroying in a matter of days a network that had been in place for 20 years. Two military attachés in Vienna and Berlin had been expelled, and more were to follow. The involvement of the lawyer Prahler in such a brutal and inept affair would make it impossible for other deep-cover agents of his stature to act, and make it difficult to recruit new ones. And who knew what else the American senator was telling? You know, Molnia, for years my service ran moles at the very heart of the British intelligence service. We even had one who acted as liaison with the CIA. Philby Burgess, McLean, and Blunt. And old man Churchill, too, if you believe the Western spy novels. Is there a point to this anecdote? I'm just trying to give you some idea of the damage you've done. Those moles paralyzed the British for over 20 years. That's what could happen to us. To both of us. Your GRU bosses will never admit it. If they do, they certainly won't discuss it with you. But that's the mess I've got to clean up. Now, if you know anything at all about me, Polyakov was certain that Molnia knew as much about him as the KGB, which meant that Molnia did not know one very important thing. You know that I'm fair. I'm old, I'm fat, I'm faceless, but I'm objective. I'm retiring in 4 months. I have nothing to gain from causing a new war between our two services. Molnia merely returned his gaze. Well, Polyakov expected as much. The rivalry between the GRU and KGB had been bloody. At various times in the past, each service had managed to have the leaders of its rival shot. There is nothing longer than institutional memory. I see, Polyakov stood up. Sorry to have troubled you, Major. Obviously the General Secretary was mistaken. You have nothing to say to me. Ask your questions. 40 minutes later, Polyakov sighed and sat back in his chair. Turning slightly, he could see out the window. GRU headquarters was called the Aquarium because of its glass walls. It fit. Polyakov had noticed, as he was driven by another GRU officer past the Institute of Space Biology, which, together with the little-used Frunze Central Airport, surrounded the aquarium, that this building, perhaps the most inaccessible, indeed even invisible place in the city of Moscow, appeared to be almost transparent. A 15-story building with nothing but floor-to-ceiling windows. To find it inviting was a mistake. Polyakov pitied the theoretical casual visitor. Before even reaching the inner circle, one had to penetrate an outer one consisting of 3 secret aircraft design bureaus, the even more secret Chelome Spacecraft Design Bureau, or the Red Banner Air Force Academy. At the far end of the courtyard below, nestled against the impenetrable concrete wall that surrounded the aquarium, was a crematorium. The story was that, in the final interview before acceptance into the GRU, every candidate was shown this squat green building and a special film. The film was of the 1959 execution of GRU Colonel Popov, who had been caught spying for the CIA. Popov was strapped to a stretcher with unbreakable wire and simply fed, alive, into the flames. The process was interrupted so that the coffin of another substantially more honored GRU employee could be consigned first. The message was clear. You leave the GRU only through the crematorium. We are more important than family, than country. A man such as Molnia, trained by such an organization, was not vulnerable to any of Polyakov's interrogator's tricks. In almost an hour, all Polyakov had pried out of him were operational details, names, dates, places, events, material that Polyakov already possessed. There was something more to be learned, a secret of some kind. Polyakov was sure of it, a secret no one else had been able to get out of Molnia. a secret that perhaps no one but Polyakov knew existed. How could he get Monya to talk? What could be more important to this man than that crematorium?